I've been doing learning a little bit about Python, trying to do a little bit of work with William on Sage, the Dr. Stein on the Sage project. And last night he wrote to me and said, "Hey, would you like to give a talk?" Now, I don't personally do anything with postage stamps, but it is something I've heard about, and it's kind of an interesting problem. This is an example of taken from Certicom's website of what a digital postage mark might look like. I think these are available. If you go to stamps.com, you can download software that lets you print postage stamps on your own envelopes. Let's see, can we switch to the...
Sure.
And the people who do elliptic curve type stuff really like this example because it's something you can really understand why an elliptic curve might be useful. And so, unfortunately, the comparison, the side-by-side comparison they have on their Certicom website is not so... it's very low resolution. But what they're trying to indicate is, you know, here would be what you would get if you use an elliptic curve to encode the postage stamp information. And here is the size you would get for similar security using RSA. And you just need it. That's just probably not acceptable. And yes, yeah, so that's how they not return it wrong.
Sorry, I'm just extremely curious what happens if you go to stamps.com.
Okay.
There it is. Indeed.
Yeah,
only $380.
I tried looking for, you know, they don't have any technical description of what they actually do on this website, which is understandable. Okay, so we were emailing back and forth, and last night about midnight, Dr. Stein said, "Hey, do you want to give a talk?" And so this is going to be a chalk talk. I work at a place near here in San Diego called CCR, and as you can probably tell by the way I'm dressed, it's more like academic mathematicians than business types. I don't think we have any MBAs at all. And, you know, we're interested in all sorts of different math problems, elliptic curves being one of them. But as I said, this postage problem is just, it's cute. When you're talking about elliptic curve public key systems, you know, usually they're compared against RSA or multiplicative group, something like that. Multiplicative group Diffie-Hellman problem. And the big reason that elliptic curves have gained some interest is that there are the best known generic attacks here are square root. Whereas here we have sub-exponential, L to the third. Let's just say sub-exponential. So what that means in practice is that in order to get something like 80 bits of security, which is shorthand for saying that you feel the system where you expect that it takes something like 2 to the 80 operations of some kind in order to break the system. Here you need 160 bits. And here you're talking something in the range of 512 to 1024 bits. I haven't, as I said, I just started doing this, working on this this morning. Because at midnight last night, I decided I need to go to bed. It's somewhere in this range, quite a bit bigger. Now, of course, if you look at the description of elliptic curves, either RSA or the multiplicative group for a field, you might say that this is hard and this is relatively easy to understand. So the question is, does it really matter that these are much smaller than the sort of problems you need to, representations you need to use over here? And the answer is, well, it really depends on the application. There are some applications where, you know, the difference between 160 bits or 1024 bits, it just isn't going to make that much difference. Neither one of these fits in a machine word for any machine I know of. So you have to use extended precision arithmetic in either case. And so if it's on a home computer, you know, it doesn't make that much difference. And RSA's been along for a long time. There are a lot of implementations out there, so why not just stick with RSA? But there are constrained environments where elliptic curves are talked about a lot. Okay, so constrained environments where this difference really makes a big difference. And they might be low power type applications, maybe smart cards. You know, so you have to maybe low power and also small die size. You need to really fit on something very small. Or low bandwidth. So elliptic curves are making some headway in things like, in the low bandwidth frame, in terms of things like wireless networks, because it's somewhat expensive to send bits back and forth in terms of overhead on packets. And another example of low bandwidth application would be postage stamps, right? I mean, there's only so much room on a standard number 10 envelope. And as we saw, in terms of the encoding that was represented there, it's already pretty squeeze to fit in that much information. If you're trying to fit in something that's, you know, at least four times bigger, you're just running out of space on the envelope. Does that make sense? It's just standard low bandwidth thing, except this is one you can really understand. There's a hard physical limitation, which is nice. So, I mean, it's pedagogically nice. It's an example where you can really understand, well, maybe it does make sense to work with elliptic curves. So let's see. Right. So I mean, as you probably know, mail rooms and large corporations have had digital postage meters for a long time, and they make postage marks, and they don't have anything that looks at all like that, that moiré pattern of bits that was on the previous thing. You've probably seen pre-stamped things that come in the mail. And the security model for the old digital postage marks was based on distinctive marks and tight control of meters. Okay, so in other words, you physically control the postage meters. It's similar to, they're very similar to cash presses. You know, you keep very tight control over the dot and the, what are they called, the plates and the presses that are able to, in the case of money, you take tight control of the paper stock that is able to create money. But that's a way of avoiding having forged postage stamps. Is it just you have to implement security procedures in order to get a postage meter, and they produce things that you can visually inspect and see this was produced by an actual postage meter, as opposed to someone taking a pen and trying to mark the same thing. Now, that means that it's only for larger companies. Not huge. I mean, you don't have to be a huge company to get a postage meter, but you do have to be able to, implement some measure of security with the postage meter. The post office would like to have a new model where you can, applicable for home and small business, where you would print on the PC. Okay, so if you can print on a PC, there can't be anything that terribly distinctive about the mark itself, right? And it absolutely is reproducible. I mean, the marks made by a postage meter were not easily reproducible, but these marks from a PC, just run the print job a second time. In fact, you'd want to be able to run the print job a second time, because if the envelope jams while going through the printer, you don't want to have wasted your, you know, however much. You want to be able to just run it again. So you have to have a different model for how you verify the validity of a stamp, and that's where an elliptic curve cryptography type application comes in. So basically, you know, this is very not a math talk so far. Basically, the idea is that there's a certain amount of information, such as the ID of the sender, the amounts of the postage that's being claimed, and let's see what other information is wanted. Oh yeah, the other things, the date. To avoid forgeries, one thing they like to do is to have a limited number of dates on which the stamp, the mail, the letter actually could be posted, so that it sort of expires after a while. Some information like this. And the basic idea is you should take this, consider this to be a message, and then sign it with a digital signature algorithm. Some kind of variation on a digital signature algorithm. Now, this is a little bit different from most digital signature algorithm applications, because you don't have to verify. I mean, typically, you've got person A and person B, and you've got in the middle, you've got your trusted authority. And you talk, A and B both talk to the authority in order to, you know, in order to get B's public key, A talks to the authority and vice versa. And then you can set up some communication back and forth where they're going to trust that they're talking to each other, and they're going to sign things using this information. And this is different in this case, because you just have the sender and the post office. And the post office is both the authority and the person with whom the communication is happening. I mean, you just need to say, prove that you paid for this stamp. So in this case, you can just use a scheme that's something along the following. The post office gives you a piece of software that knows a private key, say little a, and they can also provide you, or you can compute for yourself, a public key, which is going to be, say, A times G, where G is a generator for an elliptic curve. Okay. So this generator is just public information. Everyone knows this. They send you A, and they record the fact that you got A. And then when you're sending something back to them, let's call this...
is there a question or comment?
Oh, yeah.
Is every given by a generator of
the
elliptic curve, or the group of points on it?
The group of points on it, given the elliptic curve.
So generator.
So there isn't necessarily for the entire group, but for any given point, it generates the group that it's the generator of.
That's fancy.
You can also erase the French D.
You don't cover it.
So actually, I mean, do you want to demonstrate at this point the...
One of their problems was to give an example of a curve for which the thing is not cyclic. Which the group
we don't know these. I just wondered whether you meant the group generated by a given point or whether you were assuming that the whole group was generated by one point.
Typically you want to, because it's better cryptographically if the group is cyclic of the prime order.
So some subgroup generated by G contained in the FQ point.
Okay.
So I won't be specific. Is it FP or is it F2 to the end? Some finite field.
Maybe that's a good time to...
And so...
Sorry.
That's okay. Should I talk or...?
I'm just going to give you an example. You could pull down the screen for just a second.
Sure.
Huge font. So just for fun for a second, we can make an elliptic curve over some finite field. Let's choose a very large prime. So say the next prime after 10 to the 20. There's our elliptic curve over a large field. Now I have to find a point on the curve. So it's y squared equals x cubed minus x. So we could, I have no idea. any idea how to find a point on the curve over a finite field? You're confronted with one. Over Q, it could be really hard because you don't even know whether there are any extras. But what would you do over a finite field? Had to find a point. Perfect. Just try. So let's try x equal to 3. So you could just try x equal to 3. Plug that in. X cubed minus x. Let's see. So the curve is x cubed minus x. So the question is 24 squared. So we try another point for another value for x, like 5, and then see whether or not that's a square. And it's not. I'm getting very lucky here.
Ask whether k of 1 is square. Oh, true. K of 9 is okay.
Let me try k of something that. Maybe I'm just very unlucky, so.
It looks like you're just unlucky.
Like half the time it should work, since randomly. there's one. I don't know. So there's the square root. So the y be that the square root actually. So we have an x and y, and these will be a point on a curve. Yes, there it is. So we now have a point on a curve. That's the g. I'll call it g, the coordinate notation on the board. And then you can multiply it by something. You can actually multiply it by some really large random thing, and you get another point. So you can very quickly. I added g to itself that many times, almost instantaneously. And it doesn't get, the numbers don't get huge like they do over the rational numbers, because you're always reducing modulo the prime. I don't know if I have that's probably a really stupid
problem.
So there you are. But we can also compute the number of points on the curve.
Have you explained the binary expansion method of computing the large?
I mentioned it briefly. I haven't really gone into detail about that. Sad. So it is in fact possible to quickly compute the cardinality of this group of things, the cardinality of the whole group. So let's see. I'll just use a trick to do it.
Oh,
you could, so kind of broken. I don't know what's wrong with this, but in any case, you can in fact compute quickly the number of points.
Well, you know, in this application, it's quite good. The point is the post office is, this is pre-computation the post office has done. You can easily verify that the order that they tell you is in fact true, because you can take your point, raise it to that order, and see if you get the group ID in the order. And it's also not so hard to verify that a prime is a prime. So you can, you know, somehow the post office has to worry about doing this pre-computation.
So we should look. Here, I'll just compute the order of this. So that's the prime.
It is worth pointing out that it wasn't that long ago that efficient algorithms for computing the group order were not known. So
make the finite field, and make the elliptic curve. Yeah, it's a major theorem that, or a major result in math, that you can do this point count efficiently. Really? Oh, I think the problem is I should say k here.
Oh, yeah.
Or actually rather,
k bar,
yeah. Okay. Finally, there. That doesn't look very prime, unfortunately.
Oh, you didn't, you just guessed some coefficients.
Yeah. So actually, this might be a very bad curve to you.
Oh, it's not so
very nice.
It's not so bad. It has a large, has a pretty large prime factor.
So probably the order of our point, I guess I can make our point again. Remember we made our random point of x, y. So it was 10, comma, a really big number. And let's find out what its order is. And then the group in which you'll do all the cryptography is the group generated by this point. Oh, wait, let me see. Okay, so it has that order. So you'll be working in a cyclic group of that order, the product of these numbers in that cofactor.
And what field are we in?
We're working over the finite field K of cardinality this. This is not very big prime, actually.
10 to the 20 plus 39, is it?
Yeah, 10 to the 20 plus 39.
But it's a prime field.
Yes, it's a prime field, FP.
There is some sort of extension of that. This would not be so easy to compute with the order.
No, it's also easy in an extension. Yeah, the algorithm works both in FP and in extension. It's due to Scoff, Elkies, and Atkin, hence it's called SEA, like the ocean. And it works in polynomial time in the number of digits of the cardinality of the field. It's very clever. Basically, it amounts to, in essence, counting the number of points, but take that number and reduce it modulo a whole bunch of small primes, count that, and then then use the Chinese remainder theorem. Of course, how do you count? How could you find this number modulo 7 or 11? That's a tricky thing, but it's something that you can in fact do. Okay, so that was our little interlude. Any questions or comments?
What was the name of that?
Oh, SEA. Scoff, Elkies, Atkin. Yeah, it's Noam Elkies. That's right. And Oliver Atkin at UIC, and René Scoff, who's, I don't know, is he in Holland these days? I don't know where he is, actually.
I don't know, actually. Yeah.
He's Dutch. Okay, so that was our interlude. Any other questions? The point is just you have a point you can add it to itself very quickly. You can make a cryptosystem in that group, in the group that generates.
So what do you want to put into the little postage stamp thing? Well, you want to identify who was sending the letter, And because of the very asymmetric nature of this communication, it's probably okay to just, let's call this capital A, A times G. So one thing we can do is we can just include capital A. Now normally, capital A is just some number. Actually a pair of numbers, X and Y coordinates. You can compress the Y out, essentially, except for one bit, but let's not worry about that at the moment. You can just, you set the X coordinate plus the information in the reduced representation of Y. Is it the smaller of the two Y values or the bigger of the two Y values? So you send a 0 over 1. Because as you know, take a square root and you get two possible values. But in this case, this is a fine identifier because the post office is going to be, this is just a piece of software sitting on your PC. It doesn't have a name. You have to give it a name. So why don't we give it the name, which is the its public key? So that serves both to provide the public key to anyone who might need to get it. That's how the public key is now public. It's going to be actually included on the postage stamp. And it also to the post office identifies who's sending this. So we'll include that, and we'll include some of the message info. So the things that I was saying before, like the amount of postage, the date that it's valid for, and perhaps some other things. If you have a requirement that you provide a return receipt, you can provide return receipt info, like an email address or a fax number, perhaps, for getting the return receipt. More timely and cost-effective way than having something mailed back to you. And then we're going to have a signature. So how does the signature going to work? Well, this is very interesting. It looks like you could use a standard digital signature algorithm, which would be to hash this information and then sign the hash. But there's some amount of this that you maybe don't want to have actually readable to the public. Like maybe you don't want to have your email address out there that anyone can read easily. Now I'm going to distinguish between someone who has a computer and someone who just picks up the letter as it's passing by and looks at it. The algorithm that Certicom suggests is a little bit complicated because they want to obscure, not actually protecting it, but just sort of obscure some of the information. So we're going to break this into two parts. Let's call this, they call this part B and this part C. So this is the open part, and this is the confidential. And then what they're going to do is you're going to take, let me get this in front of me so I don't take too long hemming and hawing. Okay, so for each message, for each stamp, we're going to choose a random k, which is less than the order of the groups that we're interested in. And just to, since I forgot to do this before, let's say that n is the size of the group. Okay, so what we have here is something like 0 less than or equal to k less than or equal to n minus 1, the standard representation. Now, you probably don't want 0, but that's also very unlikely to happen if you're doing this randomly. So the part of the security is going to be on your ability to choose good random numbers here. And then we compute, R, which is going to be k times g. And this is this R is the session key. In other systems, you would call this a session key. And then you use an encryption algorithm. Some symmetric algorithm, some symmetric key algorithm to produce D, which is going to be something depending on R of C. Okay, so let's call this C. So this is an encipherment of C. Okay, so possibilities here, C could be like AES of the confidential part using R as a key, or it could be very simple. Little c could be R bit anded with capital C. I mean, just something that requires knowing R in order to decrypt it. And then you produce a hash. It's just going to be a hash of, well, you can concatenate.
Comments or questions?
Oh, yeah, go.
Question is, I'll help everybody.
I didn't see where C was going.
Oh, yeah, there's, right. So there's some amount that's just published in the open and some amount that's confidential, not exposed to the casual viewer.
What is hash?
Right, so a hash is some way of taking an arbitrary number of bits and compressing it down to a fixed number of bits. And a good hash should make it difficult to to reverse the process. So if you know a fixed number of output bits, it should be difficult to produce an input that hits that number of output, I mean, that specific set of output bits.
Like a very famous one recently attacked was MD5, which is just like some of those phrases, but some people have cleverly figured out how to unfortunately get two messages that go to the same thing.
Yeah, I don't know the exact status of that, but that certainly was in the news recently.
So what K is secret here, right? And so is G.
Right, K is secret, but it's not a long-term secret. It's just for this message.
Sure.
And
G is not secret.
G is K. So far, secret things are K and R and A. And I'm saying this is confidential. It isn't going to be in secret in any way that you would, you know, want to trust. It's going to be if you have the hardware, you can reproduce this back out. You don't have to know any of the secrets. What I'm trying to say is, you don't need to know any of the secrets to get C back in the scheme that's proposed. So it's just sort of obscured from normal human, just casually looking at something and seeing what it is. And so we're going to hash down something like V and, in Sage, I guess, well. So a standard notation here is just a slash to mean to concatenate bit strings together. That's not in Sage, I think, but we could add it. It would be very...
It's like OR, just overload OR.
Yeah. But, well, you would need a class of bit strings in order to distinguish it from integer or. So we're going to concatenate just the bit string for V with, let's say, A, which is identifies who's sending the message, and this encrypted bit here. So now notice what's in here is who's sending it and also both parts of the message, where the one part of the message is encrypted, but all of the message is encoded in here. Okay, and then what do you send?
So just to clarify, mm-hmm. So every sender has their own private key, little a.
That's right.
And each sender has their own public key, big A.
Right.
Okay.
Could you say something about why you encrypt capital C here?
Yeah, that's a very... This is a complicated... This algorithm is complicated by the fact that they wanted to encrypt little c, and it's strictly to make the cost of recovering information like this so expensive that people like spammers aren't going to try to do it. I mean, you'd have to actually intercept the mail and run it through a machine in order to read it off. Whereas if it was just printed on there, then you could imagine that a spammer might get a second to glance at something and recover like someone's personal email address. And you really don't want the post office leaking email addresses. People would be very unhappy with that. So as I've been emphasizing, it's not really encrypted, as you'll see in a moment. But you'd have to do something like break federal laws about tampering with mail in order to have a piece of mail long enough to be able to decode it. That's sort of the idea. Okay, and... And then, this is great. So then we compute D, which is going to be A times H plus K mod N. Okay. So this is very El-Gamal-ish. Have you talked about El-Gamal?
No.
Okay, so this will look very El-Gamal-ish when you find out about El-Gamal. And then you send, see, I guess we can just barely fit this very bad blackboard technique, sorry, not doing a lot of teaching. Then you send A to identify who this came from and to allow people to decrypt the message. It's the public key. Which is public, there's nothing secret about that. You send V, because that was the open part of the message information, and you send C, which contains the encrypted part of the message information, and you send D, which is the signature. Now notice, this much of it you probably would have had to send anyway, like who's it coming from and the parts of the message. So this is the part over here. This is the overhead, which is the encryption. Okay, so now how do we decrypt? So we're given A, B, C, and D. So if you're the post office, you look up in your database, let's see, now let me make sure this is right. No, I don't think you need to do this. Let me just follow the algorithm. So to decrypt. Okay, to decrypt, given those things, then you sort of, well, you compute H, which is the hash of V, A, and C, little c, because that information is all handed to you in the message. So you can hash it back, you can recover H. And then you compute D, then you compute D times G minus h times a. Okay. And then let's expand that out. D is a times h plus k.
How did you get capital C?
That's a g.
Oh, elliptic curve now.
Yeah. So now this is this is as an element of the elliptic curve Q. So D is A times H plus K times G, and then we're subtracting off H times A, that's H times little a times G.
What's capital A again?
I erased it. And capital A is little a times G. And so this gives us K times G, which we call R. So we've recovered R. And now we've got capital C and we've got R. So we decrypt C. Recover capital C is the inverse decryption of a little c. What, according to whatever the inverse of the encryption algorithm is, if it's bit XOR, then you just bit XOR again and it comes back out, or you run the AES decryption algorithm, or whatever it is. And so then you get capital C. Now notice, I didn't need to know anything secret in order to do all of this. So at this point, now we know. Now we know V and C, which equals the entire matrix. Now this is why I was saying that the encryption of little c didn't actually give you any hard cryptographic security, because you didn't need to know any secrets to get capital C back. But it just, for the post office application, we're talking maybe $5 for, a larger box. It's not a lot of money. For any given package. And so probably that's good enough security for just things like return receipt info. Now, on the other hand, what you didn't recover in this whole process was little a. Nowhere in there there was no information about little a, except for the fact that capital A is little a times g. That's the whole point. Because if you could get someone's little a, then you could send mail on their account so that they get charged for the mail that you're sending.
And notice that all information needed to get a little a is available to you.
Oh yeah, all you needed is capital A.
It would take a billion years.
If you need capital A and G and E and FQ.
It's all there.
Yeah, it's just, it would take a very long time. So that's the algorithm. If you look at how long this is, basically the message, this part was sort of necessary to send anyway. The overhead is this D was computed as being some integer mod n. So it's the size of the elliptic curve group that you're working on. And that's why you like something like an elliptic curve, because the group order you're working with is smaller than, say, an RSA type application would be. So that's it. Hope I didn't. This is on the group.
Yeah.
But it's in a cyclic group of order.
Yeah. So in terms of finding little a, is there anything better than the naive algorithm? Just trying.
Yes.
Everything times.
Yes. The standard approach is the easiest. Yes. Is it okay if I erase? So I mentioned this. So trying everything is a linear. Yeah. So that would take n times a small constant number of bit operations. The square root attack here.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't mention it. There's a square root. So what you can do is you choose something like, say, s is approximately going to be an integer. S, which is approximately the square root of n. Okay, so maybe you take the square root of n and round it down. And then you enumerate all the values g times 1, g 2 times g, s, let's say n over s, I don't know which way, say rounded up times g, something, let's just say s. Let's pretend that there is an exact square root, it'll be easier.
Throwing in an extra one could only help.
Yeah. So, say we round that up, so. And then we compute that, and then we also compute a minus s times g, a minus 2s times g, a minus 3s times g, up through a minus s squared times g. And then you look for something on this list to be something on that list. And when that happens, so let's suppose we write little a as being alpha times s plus beta, where alpha and beta are less than or equal to s. You have to convince yourself that you can do that, but s is around the square root of the size, so you can write it in base s and you get an alpha and a beta that do this. So then,
just for the sense, don't come in.
So then what we find is that beta times g is equal to alpha. Oh, right. I can rewrite this equation. This equation I can rewrite as saying that beta is equal to a minus alpha s, and therefore beta times g is equal to a minus alpha s times g, which we can rewrite as capital A minus alpha s g. And so the beta g occurs on this list, and the a minus alpha sg occurs around this list. So there will be a repeat. So you compute these two lists, each are about square root in length, and then you have to do a comparison between the lists, which means you do something like sort them and then compare. Well, that's not so efficient, but really the efficient thing to do is to sort them together and then look for where the repeat is. But when you do that, you want to keep track of where they came from. So you make a data structure that says, 1, 2, comma s, and over here it says, 1, 2, 3, 2, s, and primes. Remember that these came from the second list. And then you sort these two things on the entire bit string, and the two where the beginning parts match will find the discrete log for you.
By the way, this is called the baby step, or
yeah,
illustration of baby step, giant step. Yeah. On the left-hand side, you have baby steps because you're just adding g each time. And on the right-hand side, you have giant steps because you're, I guess, you're subtracting s times g each time,
yeah,
which is a big step or a giant step.
Yeah, so, I mean, in practice, I guess what you really do is you create this list and you index it. And then for each of these, you check, is it on that list? But basically, 2 times the square root of n times log n to
that isn't linear. So it's better than linear in short.
Certainly, yeah. It's roughly square root.
Difference between a million years and a thousand years.
And then it's root n log n.
Yeah, it's something like root n log n. Because of the sort, either sort or you, each time you're doing a lookup for here, the lookup is like a log n. Yeah.
Or log root. Oh, it's a constant.
Yeah, that's a constant. Yeah. I was too specific when I said two. It's some constant, some smallish constant.
Yeah.
Root n log n.
We can also use a variant of this algorithm to find the group structure of an elliptic curve over a finite field. Because this is giving you A in terms of G. So this is, if you want to find the group structure, you start at some point, you find another point, you write it in terms of the first one, if possible, and you kind of iterate this process. You end up building up a whole group with luck.
In some known time. But if you just miss all the points that are in some
sequence. It's a random algorithm.
It's a random 4 through n time.
This would be very unlucky.
You have to be very unlucky. But it sounds like that's outside the range of the course.
Yeah. So, any comments or questions? Further? Okay, so.
Okay, so time to
look at this day.
Sure, of course.
Yes.
We can work on problem.
Problem development. Yeah. It was to write a program to crack an elliptic curve of the system in less than a bazillion years. Sorry. If you just did it.
Okay, so one I told you requires a lot of memory.
Yeah, that's a serious problem. Yeah. Oh yeah, so as you do, you have to be.
You only said that it's allowed to run a gazillion years. You didn't say it's allowed to keep adding memory or something.
No, nope, it absolutely isn't. So maybe I should make that clear in that problem. So it can run for a trillion billion years, but you do have to use a single normal modern computer. So you can't use a trillion billion megabytes or terabytes of space. So
you might end up using a much more stupid algorithm that uses less space.
And it might be fast enough. Okay, so I'm gonna talk about, I don't have so long, but I'll talk about, or at least start talking about these notes. So I'll tell you a very simple way to use an elliptic curve to set up a sort of a secret code between two people. So let's suppose we're these two guys, Diffie and Hellman, invented the first public key crypto system that they was revealed to the wild. So there was a similar system invented earlier at GCHQ by Clifford Cox, but here's how it works. These two people fix an elliptic curve. Very, very simple. Fix an elliptic curve. Over FQ. Or even, we're supposed to say over FP, or prime P. And you fix a point P, capital P, on the elliptic curve. So we just publicly agree on those two things, just like we did when I was playing with the computer a minute ago. We chose a curve, and we chose a point on the curve. Now here's what you do. Diffie chooses a random number, I'll call it D for Diffie, and Hellman chooses, this is an integer between 2 and the order of the point, which again I'll call capital N. if he chooses this random number, Hellman chooses H with two less than or equal to H less than N. And now the fourth step is that Diffie secretly, see, only he knows D so far, secretly computes D times P. And you know, about the same time, Hellman computes H times P. Remember, in each case, you can do this very quickly. You'll get some explicit point on the curve. And then finally, they tell each other the points that they compute. And now Diffie knows H times P, so he can compute D times H times P. On the other hand, Hellman knows D times P, so Hellman can compute H times D times P. And these look like they might be different because the order is different, but in fact, those two points are the same because D, H, P is D, H, P, which is H, D, P, which is H, D, P. So you're just adding P to itself, H times D times. So you consider this your shared secret. You could both of you very easily know this point on the curve. It's D times H times P. You can both compute it, but somebody watching the transactions between you, what you did was you agreed on the curve, agreed on the point, and you publicly sent to each other D times P and H times P. If you watched all of that, it would be still difficult to recover or to figure out what D times H times P is. So this is the secret. It's a very simple way that two people who communicate in plain view, but they can secretly scribble on a pad onto each computer without anybody looking at what they do on the computer at least, can agree on a secret without without having to sort of send somebody with a briefcase to transport the secret from one person to another. So
that's the Diffie-Hellman key exchange.
And it works just as well. You don't have to use an elliptic curve. When Diffie and Hellman did it initially, they instead of choosing a point on an elliptic curve, they chose an element P in the group Z mod P Z star, the group of units of the integers modulo P. This elliptic curve version of it came a little bit later. So it's a way of agreeing on a shared secret. And in order to figure out what DHP is, if you only knew D times P, H times P, and the other stuff that's published, well, you could do it in theory, again, by, you know, given P and D times P, you could figure out D just by trying all possibilities. It would take forever, but in theory, it's possible. And then, you know, if you had that, you could figure out D times H times P. But in a practical amount of time, it seems very difficult, unless you choose your elliptic curve in an extremely stupid manner, to figure out this shared secret, given only the information that you saw go back and forth publicly. And it wasn't until the late, I think around, I don't know the exact date, but I think it was maybe, I was born, so maybe around 1976, that this first public way of sending, of agreeing on a secret key was arrived at. Actually, it's very amazing. If you look at MathSciNet, you can find a review of Diffie and Hellman's original paper. And the it ends with a statement of the form, the referee is not convinced, or the reviewer is not convinced by just this whole idea of a public key system. So, also, Diffie and Hellman were a little annoyed because they didn't really have any control over how this secret key is chosen. It's just, you know, they do some random work and then they both get the secret key. And then they can communicate using, for example, these symmetric ciphers that were mentioned earlier. But somehow you feel like it's a little bit out of your control and you're being taken along for a ride. So it has a lot of drawbacks. So now I'm going to tell you about something called LDML. This is, you'll see that this is similar to what Joe described. It's a crypto system based on an elliptic curve, or more generally, you could also do it in this group. And it has much better properties. You can do digital signatures using it. You can also post a public key, and then people can send you messages that only you can decrypt. So anybody can send messages, anybody can set up the crypto system, but only you can decrypt. So instead of just being able to agree on a shared secret, this is better because it allows you to sign messages, etc. I'll explain it, though, in the specific context of... it doesn't say anywhere that Microsoft had anything to do with this in the notes because I didn't want to get sued, but they did. So there's Microsoft's digital rights management system. So at some point in the late 90s, like maybe 1999 or 2000, Microsoft had one variant of their system for distributing music files so that only the buyer can play the file and nobody else can. So it turned out that embedded in the system was an elliptic curve, a very specific elliptic curve, which you'll see in a moment. It's at the bottom of page 113. So it used the Elgamal crypto system, and I'll explain how.
You need to turn your recorder back on, right?
Actually, I just put my finger over the microphone. So I think I did a very good job at stopping it. Okay, so the elliptic curve is given here. It's the prime is 7859, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It looks like kind of a random looking prime. This is at the bottom of page 113. Actually, if you write it in base 16, you'll find that it's 89 ABCDEF 0123456 72. You know, it basically has counting up in hexadecimal digits of e pi and square root of 2. So engineers at Microsoft who set up this crypto system had a sense of humor and decided to choose their prime in a fun way. By the way, if you wanted to choose a fun prime, say...
What's the 89?
That's just how it started. They just started that way. Okay. But say you wanted to choose a really fun prime number that, say, encoded your name in some way in the year and, you know, your girlfriend's name, your boyfriend's name, whatever. How would you do that? Any ideas?
Encode that and choose the nth number prime.
Okay. That could be tricky though, because do you mean like you make that big number and then you just take
July 29th, you know, the 729th prime.
But what if your number that you want, I want the actual digits of the prime too.
Okay, actually.
Yeah, just like they did here, they made a prime in hexadecimal that looks really cool. So how can you make a prime that looks really cool? You're really nerdy and you start doing that sort of thing. Yes?
I mean, you sage, do that at
okay.
Couple zeros right next prime.
Excellent, that does it. Yeah, just use the next prime function. Perfect.
Depending on if you insist on the last digit.
Well, what's this one like? This one ends with a mysterious F7. So they did exactly what you said. Because it has e pi root 2 and then suddenly this weird F7 at the end.
They might have added the 89 also.
Yeah, well, but at least that. You're right, they might have added that, but at least it kind of matches up because the counting goes A, B, C, D, E, F, 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and I guess you could think of it as looping around to 8, 9. They moved it around a little bit. Yeah, there's an F7 at the end. The actual elliptic curve they chose is given at the very bottom of the page, and I haven't written the coefficients in hexadecimal, so I don't know whether or not they have some cool pattern. Also, you can count the number of points on the elliptic curve, and you get that big number. And it turns out that the group of points on that elliptic curve is cyclic, and the generator is given explicitly at the top of page 114. So I'm going to explain the use of this crypto system in the context of the TV show La Femme Nikita. Not the movie, but the TV show La Femme Nikita. If you haven't seen it, there are two anti-terrorist people who are named Nikita and Michael, and they spend their days fighting terrorists and so on. But they do it sort of against their will. They've been roped into it. So, and the people they work for are always trying to make their life very difficult for some mysterious reason I don't understand. Okay, so here's the setup. So Nikita and Michael, when they're not off fighting terrorists, they share digital music, which, given the people, you know, all the stuff they're doing, that there's copyright violations aren't really an issue for them. So. So here's what happens. Nikita is very honest, and she you know, signs up for Microsoft's music distribution service, and it installs some software on her computer. In particular, it generates a private key, an integer n, which is given here. It's just some big integer. And it hides it all over. It wants to make it so that she can't easily find it, so it obfuscates it by hiding it all over the computer. And She then downloads some music from the website, you know, to try out her new thing, and it works. She downloads a Juno Reactor song, and she downloads the license for the song after she gets the file. She plays it in Windows Media Player. Everything works wonderfully. Then she says, "Hey, Michael, I've this wonderful song. Do you want to try it out?" So he copies it to his computer, and when he tries to play it, it won't work at all. So they're very frustrated, and being the spies, the anti-terrorist people that they are, they try to figure out exactly what's going on and defeat this this restriction of their ability to copy music. Okay, so let me tell you how the system works.
So you have Lipticurve E.
Exactly as I've given you.
You have a point P.
Make sure you're right. Let me make sure the notation's the same. So actually I have a point B, which is a generator
for the group of points on the elliptic curve. We have a private key N, which is secretly hidden in the most crazy, obfuscated way all over the place in Windows. And it's just some big integer. And we set up a public key crypto system.
What happens is that when Nikita downloaded the license to play the music on her computer, her public key was transmitted to the website. The website then generated an encrypted version of the license that could be decrypted by Nikita using the private key. So now I have to describe to you what her public key consists of, and then how it can be used to encrypt messages to her, and how it can be used by her, at least with knowledge of the private key, to decrypt messages sent to her, such as a license file.
So the public key is the following.
It's the following data. Let's see where I wrote it down.
Basically everything I've written down so far. E, this chosen point, and the one thing that only Nikita's computer can compute, which is the private key times B.
That's her public key. Now I'll tell you how to send her a message.
Particularly I'll tell you how the music distribution encodes the license file to her. So how to encrypt a message to Nikita's computer. Okay, here's what you do.
So the first thing to do is to encode, well, you break your message up into chunks and then encode it as points on the elliptic curve, as a sequence of, say, x-coordinates of points on the elliptic curve. And it turns out that specifically in the case of MS-DRM, the license file is just the x-coordinate of one single point on the elliptic curve, and the point isn't that big. So you make a point, which I'll call P, equals x, y, and this x-coordinate is the license file. So that's step one. You encode the message as a point. Two, you generate a random integer R. And again, this R falls within this range over here. Three, you compute R times P. Four, compute. So far nothing that you've done has anything to do with Nikita's public key. So you have to do something that involves this point right here. So you do is you compute R times N times P. It's the only thing you can do that somehow involves this point and this random number that you generated. Okay, so now you just that's it, that's the encrypted message. The encrypted message is the pair RP and RNP. I think I missed something. Actually, it's. I think that's right. And B plus RNP. Yeah, here we are. So that's the encrypted message. It looks extremely
We don't know n.
Does it believe us? We know r times n times p, because we know, oh, b, sorry, that's the problem, b. Don't know much. Okay, so you compute r times nb. You take the last component of Nikita's public key, which you know because she publishes it, and you compute your random thing times it. And of course, everybody knows b, so you could publish r times
p.
I think I completely,
p.
Yeah, yeah. This should be p, if you're obscuring it with p, it should be r times b. Good. Okay, because you couldn't compute r times, well, you could compute r times p, but what would be the point? So you compute r times b, and you make that part of the encrypted version of the message. You compute r times n times b, and you add that to p, which is the secret, and this will look totally random to people. And this is something that you've computed, which also looks pretty much random. And now this information, the pair RB and P plus R times N times B, this is enough for Nikita's computer to figure out what P is. All she has to do is take the second component here, take the first component here, R times B, multiply it by N, which she knows, and she'll get N times R times B. Then she subtracts that off from the second component and recovers P. So that's how you decrypt. This is how Nikita decrypts, or really Nikita's computer. So it takes the point P plus R N B, which you get, minus N times R B, which you get the R B part, and you know N, Nikita's secret. And you take that difference, you get a P. P being the license file that's needed to allow you to play the music. The music won't play unless you have that specific P. So that's how you encrypt and decrypt. So it's now 20 minutes after, so I better stop. But what I'll do next is, well, I'm almost done, but what I'll do next is say a little bit more about what happens in practice.
Maybe it's because the two head people, the head guy and the head girl, they used to have a romance, so maybe they're jealous that things wouldn't work out for Berkoff and Nikita. That's why they give them all that trouble.
That wouldn't make any sense if you hadn't seen the show, but it makes a lot of sense to me. But anyways, this is the way the system works. The way it was cracked by the hacker was he just loaded up the software that does the decryption into memory and then just read the key out. The key is hidden all over the place in various files, but if you just run the software basically using a debugger, the key gets assembled together in one place, then you can just get it. It's really stupid. Then once you know that you could, once you know N, then you can do anything.
It's not as stupid as a lot of programs just changing one bit somewhere for if you have the license number. A lot of programs do that. So
yeah, the licenses, often it's just the sum of the digits is 0 mod 7 or something. I've seen that before.
Really?
Yeah. This isn't used anymore, right?
A lot of times it's
I don't think so. It was used, though. I mean, both of us got this as an email at Berkeley from... this guy at Berkeley sent it around, and it was published on the web by this real screamer guy how to crack the system. And that was when it was actually being used, so...
Well, I mean, these types of things aren't really designed to hide something from yourself.
Yeah, that's kind of a problem, because, you know, Microsoft thought they could just break up the key, put it all over the place, and then you wouldn't be able to use it. But it's still sitting on your computer, so you have to go look at it.
It still has to be reconstructed at some point.
Yeah.
I mean, in order to avoid something like this, you'd have to run it in... kernel mode or something. Like that.
Yeah.
And even then, you can run it in VMware.
Yeah, use an emulator of a Windows computer and watch everything that happens. Yeah.
So, I don't know if there's a reasonable way to answer this, but how often is it that the effect is generated?
That's a good question. I don't know. Anything about statistics, E of P being cyclic?
Or, I mean...
It's either cyclic or a product of two cyclics. I don't know. Actually, I think I... read a paper about this. There's a lot of various questions you can ask. Like you take one curve over Q and then ask how often is it, if you consider it over FP?
For various times.
Yeah, what's the density of primes P such that it's cyclic? So for example, in both of your homework assignments, I think you proved the density was zero
for that.
You did a curve with two torsion, but all its two torsion will be cyclic. What if you do a curve without that one constraint, and then look at the reductions? How often will it fail to be cyclic? There's a paper by Alina Kojikaru on this, which I can point out to you if you want. That's one question, but another question is just if we take a random elliptic curve, what are the odds? I don't know anything about that. What do you know? Do you know anything?
No.
Joe? Okay.
But it is either cyclic or...
Or a product of two cyclic groups. Yeah, it can't be any bigger than that. You can't have a product of three. That can't, I mean, it can always be written, it can always generate by at least two elements. It's either cyclic or very close to means.
Even if it doesn't necessarily have to be defined over Q, I see why that would be reasonable from something coming from a curve just defined over Q.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be. But you can always lift your curve. Well, if your curve's over FP, you can always lift it to Q just by taking stupid choice of lifts of the coefficients.
Okay.
If it's over F, an extension of FP, then you often can't do that.
Again, it's always...
Well, it could be...
Or any kind of field.
Wait.
But the two-generator.
Yeah, the two-generator effect is over any finite field at all.
Okay.
Yeah. That would be a good, be a good project for your course section. It's a nice effect. I was very surprised about it. I found out about that at the Arizona Winter School from some random student there. And I was completely convinced he was wrong until I tried to prove it to myself. Any comments or questions?
Is there any reason why we need to multiply by the bar?
Let's see. What would happen if you didn't? If you just sent B and P plus NB?
Because everyone knows.
How would you? You wouldn't know R.
No, just set R equal to 1 and see if there's any problem.
Oh, I see.
I guess it...
And everyone knows B and NB.
Yeah. But they do anyways.
Then you can't send the same.
People know NB, so you can just subtract it off.
Yeah.
So if R equals 1, if you didn't do this, then just given this, anybody, since everybody knows the key is public key, anybody can knows this point, so you can just subtract it off that. So that's the reason. It's very important. And in practice, you also want to, if the information is encoded as the x-coordinate, you want to add some random salt to the, or some random data to the x-coordinate, so that if you encrypt the same thing twice, you get a different answer each time. That helps defeat chosen plaintext attacks on these sorts of things. That's probably not so important for this location.
Speak back in office.
Yeah. Speak back in office. Yeah, sure. What was that?
So I didn't have a question about this, but thanks again for your notes. I didn't have the PS trick.
So, okay, cool. Thanks a lot again.
Hard drive, did you bring the hard drive?
Yes, it's in my backpack.
Okay.
With all the necessary cables, I'm glad you remembered. There it is. So plug it in, there's a lot of stuff on it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Thanks.
Basically, just try whatever latest distributions you want, see which one you like. You might want to try Ubuntu, it's really trendy right now.
Oh, dear. I haven't heard of it.
It means humanity in some African language. It's basically a fork of Debian, but specifically for PC hardware and specifically with the goal of making a lot of the latest software available and having regular updates and having it be stable. And like Debian kind of gets dated for some reason, so you can try that. And once the installs are somewhat minimal because I didn't want everything to be there for testing, but once you install a system, usually, at least if it's Debian or Ubuntu, it's really easy to add new stuff.
Okay.
So, but you can try several or something like you can even try BSD. Okay, see you later.
So I didn't end up having the right style file, so...
Oh, no.
I copied your splines and everything.
Uh-huh.
So I think